Synchronized is sponsored by the Production Music Association, the leading advocate and voice of the production music community. Become a member and help us to fulfill our mission. Go to pmamusic.com and click on membership for more info and to sign up.
Well, hello there. This is episode 34 with John Clifford. And of course, Simon is also here to join me and ask all the questions that he doesn't want to answer, John. But we're going to be nice to him, don't you think, Simon? We should
definitely
be nice to him, right?
Yeah, love him.
That's good. I hope so, guys. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you, John. You're founder and CEO of True Road Music, your new venture, and we're going to talk about that. And before that, you were, I'm trying to get this in one go, Executive Vice President and Global Managing Director of BMG Production Music.
That's correct. That's what I was. They like long titles, but that's correct.
And John, before and that, you were at Universal, yeah? What was your role at Universal?
So I spent I spent sort of 20 years at Universal, but in its first, okay. So I could take you through sort of how I got into this business. Perhaps that's something you want to know, but
yes, please.
Yeah, Universal. I was the managing director for their UK business, but how I got into production music, I sort of fell into it by accident, almost straight out of school when I was 18. So I knew, well, at that point in time, like a lot of people who get into the business, I was a singer. I had stars in my eyes. I thought that I wanted to be an artist, and so I'd sent demos of some songs that I'd recorded around to music publishers and to record labels, and I got a call up from an independent publisher out in Sydney at the time, where I was, obviously grew up in Sydney. I'm Australian, and he called me in for a chat and said to me, "Yeah, you've got a great voice. You can sing really well, but what else can you do?" And I said to that I was always fancied myself as a bit of an entrepreneur and a self-starter, and I just wanted to and if he gave me an opportunity, in the business, I'd be happy to work hard and learn and listen. And so he said to me, I've got this area of my business, which is production music. Do you know anything about production music? And I said, I've got no idea what production music is. But he briefly explained it to me and said, well, if you want a job doing that, he said, I'll teach you the ropes. You'll be our guy. It'll go out and see all of the radio and TV stations and all of our media clients around Australia and New Zealand. And you can, if you want that job, you can start on Monday. And this meeting was Thursday, the week before. And so there you have it. On the 25th of January 1993, I started in this business as a junior account manager, knowing nothing about it. At that time, he represented the Focus Music Catalog, Parry Music, Omni Music, and Studio G.
Which publisher was this?
I should have said it was Nightlight Music in Sydney, and he run by a guy called Peter Beveridge. So hello Peter, if you're listening. He gave me my start in this business and all those 30 years ago. And he had some other aspects to his business as well. He had a publishing catalog, Jewel Music, which was the songs of Chuck Berry, John Lee Hooker, a lot of 50s and 60s rock and roll stuff. He also had recording studios and a small record label. So it was a really, even though I was predominantly production music, it was a small business, and so I dipped my toe in the water of a lot of different sort of things and got to see how the music business in general can, different aspects of the music business can work together collaboratively, which was really good. So I worked for him for 4 years, and then I was approached by Zomba Production Music at the time in Australia, who were at that time the market leaders for production music there, and got a call up from Stuart Livingston, who was running Zomba Production Music at the time, and I joined them as a radio account manager. That was in 1997. Became head of marketing and sales for them a few years later, and then of course in 2000 and where are we? We were around about 2003. The old BMG bought Zomba, And it became that production music business. It became known as BMG Zomba in most territories around the world. At that point in time, the management changed, and I became general manager of that business at that particular point in time. And then a few years after that, of course, BMG sold to Universal. So that is how I ended up at Universal in Sydney and running their production music business, which I did till 2012. And then I moved to the UK with my family, got an offer with Universal to move to London, initially on a 12-month contract to look after Universal's Universal Production Music's technology development. So I was doing a maternity leave cover for 12 months, and that went well. And at the end of that 12 months, they offered me a role to take over as general manager, managing director for the production music business of Universal in the UK. That was 2013, and then fast forward to 2017, approached by the new BMG to join them in a global role to help build that business around the world, and was working alongside the managing director of that business, who was Hert Willem Koolhof. You might know him, fairy Dutch guy. So he was the managing director. I came in to run the UK business and also global sales, marketing, and repertoire. But then GW left late in 2019, and from then on was responsible for running the global production music business for BMG. Alongside, I should say, I co-led the business with Dan Pounder, who used to be at Extreme. So Dan and I are good mates, and he was my running partner for a couple of years, and it was great fun.
So it's safe to say that it's safe to say, John, you have some experience in the production music industry, right?
I'd like to think so, 30 years or so. And the funny thing is, you know, it's been one of those careers for me where I think I've been a little bit lucky. I've been in the right place at the right time when acquisitions have taken place. But also, too, you know, I've worked hard, and I've also probably. I was thinking about it the other day, and really, I think there's probably a role or you know, something in this business, a role in the production music business that I really haven't sort of, you know, an aspect of it that I haven't touched one way or another, either directly or indirectly, over those 30 years. So yeah, that's me.
Question. What I find intriguing is that if you look at Australia, it's a relatively small market, but I think it's highly competitive. Is that right? Or it was highly competitive.
It is a relatively small market. It's still, you know, by global standards, there are certainly smaller markets than Australia and New Zealand. There's still a reasonable business out there for certain. It absolutely was very competitive, and I think really competitive on the technology front, very very early, probably before, you know. You're probably before the World Wide Web, or as it was sort of growing, because the internet connections and the infrastructure was simply not available in Australia to have decent download speeds. It really became a market that was driven by hard drives and Beatbox, who is a great publisher down in Sydney, Australia. Peter and Barbara, who run that business for many years, you know, they really dominated that market with the hard drive system that they had created, and all credit to them. They gave us all a very, you know, a run for our money.
So, John, talk to us about what you're doing now. What having left BMG,
having left
where
BMG,
are you now?
Having left BMG, I was meant to still be at BMG for another 12 months. So for no need to discuss sort of the ins and outs of it, but came to a mutual, you know, amicable decision to leave at the end of last year. So, I am for the next... Basically what I've decided to do now is to sort of... I'm taking my time out at the moment, really to discover what I really want to do next. That is definitely connected to this business, but I've, or to the production music business, of course. And I've started True Road Music. It's yet to be seen sort of what True Road Music actually becomes, guys, to be honest, because at this point in time, it really is a personal services company, and I'm offering consultancy services to a range of production music clients. I have been really pleasantly surprised as to sort of how many people have approached me since I've left BMG, various labels that, you know, see a value in my experience to help them in various ways, whether that be short-term projects or slightly longer-term. And so I'm working with a number of clients, and that's keeping me pretty busy at least for the next few months, which is great. And from there we see what True Road potentially becomes. You know, there's opportunities potentially with some of the clients that I'm working with, that those relationships may expand to be something bigger in time. It may be that True Road Music becomes a sub-publisher of third-party production music labels for the UK in its own right, and I build a team again around that, or it might be something that I expand out for on a multi-territory basis. And I might, I may well give the world yet another production music label and create True Road Music as a new label. And
that was one of my questions, actually, John. Are you thinking of starting a new production music label?
Quite possibly, Ferry. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's there and something that I may well consider doing. It's probably one of those things that I think when we spoke before, Ferry, I said, you know, does the world really need yet another production music label? And I'm many listening to this podcast would be screaming no right now as loud as they possibly can. And to some extent, I probably agree. But look, I may well do that. It's probably not my main focus. It's not what I'm thinking about right now. The consultancy stuff's keeping me really busy. And to be honest, I'm really enjoying the variety of conversations that I'm having with people. So that's really refreshing to be out of the corporate environment that I've been in for so long, to be sort of working for myself and working and having some great conversations with some independents and people that I've, you know, probably haven't had a great deal of time to speak to before, but now do, and it's fantastic.
So, John, if you start your own label, if it does become a publisher, would you go the traditional sub-publisher route, or would you become a global player? Obviously, the internet allows you to do so, and we've had lots of discussions on this podcast about the demise of sub-publishers and the how irrelevant territories are nowadays in exclusive contracts. I wonder. I mean, you come from a very traditional library background. I wonder what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, very, very good question. My opinion on this is that it firmly in the camp of in support of sub publishers per territory. I followed that conversation a little bit that you may have had with others on here, and I get the side of the argument where people say, you know, it's a global business. It's about global deals. It's about some of the global players, the new SVOD services, global broadcasters being able to do global deals like that, and that sub publishers, potentially restrict in that regard. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this business is and has always been and continues to be a relationship business. It's a people business. I believe people do deals with people, not necessarily with companies. So for me, I would absolutely go the sub-publisher route. And if I did establish True Road Music as a label, I would be looking for sub-publishing in all of the relevant territories that you can imagine. I think, you know, it makes perfect sense to say, you know, if you're a major and you can put your own offices on the ground, your own sales teams on the ground in multiple territories, then of course you're going to do that. But, you know, if this business was able to run centrally without any sub-publishers or without people on the ground, then why are the majors like Universal and like BMG investing in teams on the ground, significant teams of people on the ground in every territory? They're playing the role of a sub-publisher you know, for themselves in each of those territories. So it's obvious that that role is still very important. And for an independent or an independent label starting up, they need that network of sub-publishers. So I think it's I don't think it's irrelevant at all.
So just following up on that, I mean, I was struck the other day when somebody offered my company a sub-publishing deal that the contract they offered me was pretty well exactly the same as the contracts I was signing 30 years ago. And that was before the internet. So I wondered if, I mean, the first thing that struck me was this is an exclusive contract and that's going to tie me down in areas of the territory. You know, we get a lot of business direct to us from our Google rankings and things. So I wonder, in this hypothetical new company, publishing company you set up, would you be looking to sign kind of hybrid exclusive deals, or convinced about the territory, the fact that territories are still relevant? Are you still feeling that exclusivity is still relevant?
To a point, absolutely. Yeah. I see what you're saying there, Simon. I think, largely exclusivity, I think, is important. I think, you need to be able to commit to a sub-publisher. They need to know that they are able to go out and work that catalogue for you with their teams that they're investing money in their sales teams and their relationships with the people on the ground there. At the same time, I think it's important that the people that, that sub-publishers, whether it's inbound, outbound sub-publishers that we're talking about here, in terms of you being a sub-publisher for potentially labels for your territory, or, you sending out your label for sub-publishing in other territories around the world. Whichever way it goes, I think it's important as sub-publishers that we offer some flexibility, or at least be open to being flexible. What I mean by that is, allowing for situations where that label or that publisher may be able to land a big deal directly with a broadcaster, for instance, and that may mean that there is synchronization that happens in the territory that you exclusively represent that music in. And in by rights, you should be able to be, approaching that broadcaster if they're making content in that particular territory. But it's been licensed directly already in one of the major territories, so you're going to miss out on that. But at the same time, the potential for the sub-publisher is that they pick up, the back-end performance revenue from that usage. So swings and roundabouts, and I think there needs to, in this new world where we are trying to, compete with both a media landscape which is changing on a global basis, as well as competitors in our business that are operating on a fully global basis with rights models which are potentially could be seen as simpler, we need to be able to be flexible and offer that flexibility to each other and work, I think, as a community.
I think what's interesting is what Simon said. The contract that he was proposed, or he got proposed now, was almost the same as 30 years ago. I also see other things. It's like all bets are off right now. It's like anything is on the table. Everything you can discuss. It's exclusive, non-exclusivity. It's the 50-50 share, which is like, there wasn't even a discussion point a couple of years ago. Now it's like 60-40, 70-30. How do you see that going?
Yeah, I think, was it 60-40, 70-30 in your favor, or the other way around?
Well, it depends on which side of the table you were.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, I'm aware. Yeah, no, look, at BMG, certainly when we were negotiating deals, we were obviously requesting a higher share on our side than it wasn't a 50-50 deal. So I think things have changed there. I think there is there's advantages to doing, you look at that from a label's perspective, coming in and signing, inking one deal with one company on a global basis. There's some convenience to that, right? With a global marketing backing that up and a global sales team in different territories backing that up. It makes your, it's a proposition which is, potentially convenient, potentially time saving, potentially less administratively burdensome. So opportunity then to be discussing, a higher rate for those things. But I think it's, I don't really, I don't really have an opinion. You know, if I was, from my side, if I was to be starting True Road Music tomorrow, I probably, as a label, I would probably not, even if I had the opportunity, which I probably would not, given that I've worked for both of those major companies that I've just mentioned, even if I had the opportunity to sign the label on a global basis to one of those companies, I probably would not. I would prefer, I think, to utilize the relationships that I've built up over a number of years to, you know, cherry pick, hopefully, my choice of, you know, who I think are the, you know, the best partners to partner with in each particular territory. And would do so on a 50-50 basis. So I think it just depends. It depends where you're at in your own business, you know, as to sort of what you can bring to the table and potentially what you can demand.
John, it strikes me that you have a very different viewpoint from most of our previous guests. And really, is that perhaps because your background is principally with the majors, and I think every one of our other guests who owns a label is an independent, and they... By and large, what they, and I'm an independent, and Ferry is as well, what we see coming down the line is the Napster of production music. It's coming at us and we need to react to it. We need to change. We need to kind of work together. We need to do something to fight off this. I get no sense of that from you at all. I kind of feel that you're entirely confident that the traditional business method is going to serve and Napster's going to go away and Universal, BMG and some of the independents will survive. Is that fair or not?
Who's the Napster that we're talking about?
Well, you know who it is.
Epidemic, Artlist.
Yeah, look, I think there's for sure, but I don't think competitors, competition's good, right? And I listened to the last episode where you interviewed the guy from Epidemic, and I had listened to what he had to say, and you know, as he said to you guys, he said, we're not planning on slowing down, but there is, you know, I don't necessarily think that they, you know, I have, having now come from two majors and been in senior roles at those two major companies, from my perspective, I have not. There's certain aspects, there's certain areas of the business, the UGC market, you know, when we look at, you know, YouTube content creators, where I think potentially there is obviously there's an advantage which Epidemic bring to the table in that regard. But then when we look at the traditional business and the broadcasters that we're dealing with, the SVOD services, there is a, you know, I'm not afraid that business is going to is going to die in the short term. I think there is plenty of business for all of us for the years to come. Let me say that.
That's interesting.
If I wasn't, I wouldn't be planning on starting my own catalog, or I'd be going into real estate and doing something completely new.
I think my point is that you're viewing it from the view of a major, but you're not a major anymore. So you know, I think you're going to. It's be interesting what you come up with, because you're going to come at it with the knowledge of how majors work, and you're going to be an independent. As you say, you're not going to immediately sign to a major. Your insight is going to be interesting. I'd love to have you back at some point, John, once you've chosen which path you're going to take.
Yeah, it's interesting, Simon, you say that. I mean, I look at, do I come at it from the perspective of a major? I'm not sure. Maybe I'm coming at it from the, you know, with the knowledge that I have, that potentially that's knowledge that can be shared and or adapted in some ways with the independents that I'm working with, to, you know, potentially give them some insights into sort of what I know. I have been surprised that people have sort of approached me sort of saying, you know, you have a lot of information that is in my head. I don't think of it as necessarily anything special, but there's some people that have said to me, you know, what you're carrying in your head is actually really valuable to some of us, and so I'm willing to share that through the, you know, the business that I'm setting up. So
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that I also saw the conversation on Facebook when we posted the episode in which Niklas from Epidemic was our guest. People think Epidemic is just aiming at YouTube. But if you look in Scandinavia, they have done some considerable things with broadcasters that changed the landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and they have. And, you know, you should reach out and get Patrick Appelgren from Universal on here for a chat. He's probably the best person to talk about that landscape and how Epidemic have impacted that broadcast business up there. Much better versed to discuss that than what I am. But yeah, you're right. They absolutely have. And they, you know, but then again, they also, yeah, there was also an attempt early on to have an impact on the broadcast market in the UK. And that was fairly short-lived, you know. So
why didn't it work in the UK, do you think?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I think there was a, you know, I won't disclose completely what I know about that business model because I may not have it completely right. It'd be wrong for me to sort of speculate. But look, I think at the time it was probably down to the fact that you know, you're talking to broadcasters that need quite a lot of scale in the music that they have access to. And I think Niklas mentioned, well, they use 30,000 unique tracks at this point in time. It's not a lot. So, you know, I think there's probably, when it comes to broadcasters making a lot of content, you know, it was probably not a viable solution for them. You know, we could go back though. We could, but then again, you know, that's not, perhaps that's not the reason, because, you know, we could look at what, you know, how Audio Network took the UK market by storm over the last sort of 15, 18 years. And they started with, not a lot of content either. And there was always, you know, it's always questionable, you know, as to at that point early on, you know, it's not great quality, you know, they haven't got great, you know, not a lot of music, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, they attacked the market very, very well from a non-MCPS perspective and performing rights only, direct licensing to independent production companies. And they, you know, they stepped into a market that at that point in time was, you know, there was elements to the rights grant that they were giving to independent production companies at that point in time that the MCPS were not addressing or not addressing effectively. So, but I think those gaps since have been filled. And, you know, from my perspective, I would look at, and certainly the teams that I've been leading, you know, in recent times, in the UK, I don't see, you know, I don't see Audio Network as a competitor that has any particular USP that we can't match anymore. Whereas once upon a time that was the case, but I don't think that is the case any longer.
Synchronized is sponsored by Ames, an AI-based music similarity search created by seasoned production music insiders. Ames has also launched auto tagging, so visit amesapi.com to get 100 tracks tagged for free.
I just want to be the devil's advocate here. I'm just going to put a statement on the table. I feel, after analyzing a lot of the stories, that maybe the success of Epidemic, Audio Network, may be down to the lack of consistency and approach of the market from the PROs. It takes a long time before the publishers and the composers get their money. It's complicated to license the music. Television stations feel that they need to pay a lot of money, and they just want something else.
Ferry, can I just follow that up, John, before you let that last sentence drop completely? You said that you don't see that Audio Network and people like that have a USP that you can't cope with. Well, surely its price is their biggest USP, and I, as an MCPS library, can't compete on price. Are you saying that the majors have found a way of competing on price that us independents can't?
I don't believe, Simon, that you you can't compete on price. I think in terms of the IPC blankets that were put into place and the changes that were made to the IPC licensing by the recommendations made by the PMAG committee, which I sat on for a while, other people that are part of that committee, it's changed now. But Dan Pounder was chairing that for a while. Ed Cox from West One also, early stages when I joined that PMAG committee from when I first came to the UK and sat on that committee. I think we did. I think we made some significant changes to the structure in which the IP, the independent production companies in the UK, are licensed, which does now compete on price in terms of the rights grant that is available to an independent production company on a blanket license basis on an annual basis, which gives them access to all MCPS repertoire, including all independents, not just the majors. It's no longer the rights grants which are given compete with what Audio Network were offering, which was a safety net, right? You pay once, doesn't matter where this program travels, you're going to be sweet. That is what was put in place with those changes. So, absolutely, hope that answers your question. I think you as an independent also have the ability to compete on that same pricing point.
And how about my point that I think that maybe the PROs and rights organizations may have made it too difficult to negotiate with the television stations and they're looking for alternatives?
Yeah, look, I think yes is a general. I mean, there's always reasons as to why negotiations may take longer or there are complications in and around it. I think PROs, I think we can all, it's easy to be critical of the PROs in terms of how slow they are sometimes and, blah, blah, blah. But, it's a complicated business as well. And, when you're trying, if you take the PRS who's trying to put together a new license for the BBC or ITV or whoever that broadcaster might be, and they're licensing commercial music as well as production music. It's all wrapped up together. When the commercial music publishers are deciding that they want to pull rights out of those blankets and provide less rights to the broadcaster than what they had previously in the previous iteration of that blanket, as an example, it becomes complex. It does slow things down. So I think without question, I think you could point to certain instances where the PROs have been slow to react, and that has given companies in the early years, like Audio Network, particularly in the UK and the Australian market, where I was from originally, where you had a mechanical rights society like MCPS or AMCOS, they absolutely got a foothold in that market as a result of just being too slow to adapt to how to license and provide a rights grant that satisfied the clients at the same level as they were satisfying them. So
the industry we've been working in, the nice thing is that we all know each other. If we go to NAB, we have a drink at the Paris Hall up or down bar, depending on how much you drink. But shouldn't we just look at it as a normal industry, and see music as a commodity?
Can you ask me that a different way? I'm not sure what the question is.
Okay, sorry. The question is that we now look at one big happy family of production music, and we didn't have any intruders. We do have intruders now, like Audio Network and Epidemic, and they look in a completely different way at the market. Isn't production music just a commodity, and shouldn't we treat it as a commodity instead of one big happy family, 50-50 splits?
Look, don't get me wrong. I'm not here to say, that I'm not competitive in the marketplace. I've been out there, and done. Absolutely. I mean, it is a commodity for the clients. I think they're they're largely blind to labels, and that's the thing. You know, it really comes down to, you know, what do we provide? We're providing the music that we provide is a means to an end for them, you know, for our clients. You know, it really is it's functional. So from their perspective, you've got a TV editor sitting there. All they want to do is to get that edit done as quickly as they possibly can, so that they can go home to their families or go out and have a drink, whatever they're up to next, you know. But they're there to get their job done, and the music that we provide facilitates that. So the quicker that they can find that right piece of music via an accurate search engine, and the quicker they can download it, get their hands on it, get it into the edit, the quicker that they can you can provide services which helps them complete their cue sheets or their reporting or whatever it looks like, you know, that's where you win. So yes, it's a commodity business, but yes, there's a number of different ways in which we compete against each other. And, you know, I wouldn't be the one that's sort of sitting here. I'm very happy to meet you, you know, to meet anybody for, you know, a beer at Parasol Up in Vegas. But at the same time too, we're competitors, you know, unless we're working as sub publishers. You know, I also see, you know, I like to win, and and that's, you know, so I don't see it that way. But you know, what I would say is, you know, again, if you look at audio network, yeah, with certain disruptors, you've got Epidemic. They're really the only catalog in the world right now that can really claim to be completely rights free because of the way that their composers are not assigned to any PRO. It's not the case with Artlist. Yeah, you could point to not a million, but there's many, many alternatives out there which are similar to what Artlist are doing, you know, providing independent artists that are putting their music up there. If you do a search on, and none of that music is necessarily exclusive. So you could find that same music that's on Artlist, you might find it, you know, that the artist's same piece of music under a different title on a different website. Well, that's not exactly, well, in which case then who's giving that license away? So from what's the USP for us then in our business in that regard? Well, it's to be able to tell the broadcaster that actually, you know, you're getting from this particular production music, MCPS production music supplier or InTradition production music supplier, is that music is exclusive. You're not going to find it anywhere else. It's not going to show up. And if we give you a license for it, we're able to give you that license, you know. So I think there's other ways for us to look at, you know, this business and the way that it works. And, I just wanted to go on and say, and then when it comes to, say, Audio Network, as I've already said, you know, they did extremely well in the UK and the Australian market. Why? Because they found a hole in the way that the MCPS and AMCOS were licensing music, and they made it easier, they made it cheaper, and they made it, they covered a grant of rights for the independent production companies, which made it watertight and safe for them to go ahead and know that, you know, use that piece of, license that piece of music once, doesn't matter where that program is sold, how many countries it's sold into, they're not going to get another bill. It took us too long to react to that, but I think we have now, at least in the UK, I think that rights grant has changed from an IPC perspective. But then look at Audio Network from the standpoint in any other territory where they're direct licensing, like the US. You know, US sub publishers don't see Epidemic as being Audio Network, I should say, as being particularly disruptive. They're not operating or licensing their music any differently to how any other US production music publisher is licensing, you know. So it depends on the region and, you know, and what territory you're in as to sort of what impact some of these competitors have.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'd say that the Audio Network, the way they disrupted the American market was by charging about a tenth for a sync of what a typical charge would be in America. I mean, I witnessed this once. I was in Vegas standing on stand of my sub publisher Music Box, big stand, beautiful, and he was playing my latest album loudly, and a lady walked up and she said, the salesman said, "So what are you looking for, madam?" She said, "Oh, I'm doing a half an hour sports documentary." And he said, "Oh, amazing. This is the guy who owns Music for Sport, perfect." And listened to his music, played her the music. She went, "Oh, that's fantastic." So she asked, "So how much would that cost me, for a half hour program?" And he said, "Well, it'd be about $2,500. And she said, "Well, I've just come from the next stand, that's Audio Network, and they said it was just $250. And he said to her, "Well, their music's shit." And off she went. And I turned to him and said, "Well, it's not, is it? You know their music is not shit. It's good music." He said, "What else can you say? What, Simon, what else can you say?" Now, that's disruption. And that's how Audio Network disrupted the market there. And that's how Epidemic are disrupting the market here. It's a cost thing. So following on to that, I'd like to ask you a question. You know, you're very senior and you're aware of the kind of ecosystem of the British MCPS-based library system. It's a 100 libraries, perhaps a lot more, some of which are small and a few of which are large. And we all have to use the rate card. We all have to charge the same. My costs are absolutely microcosmic compared to the majors, but I still have to charge the same amount. And when Ferry talks to me about this, he thinks we're bonkers. He just doesn't get this idea of a rate card. And I wonder what your view is on the rate card, John, whether you think it benefits the ecosystem or whether it benefits the people who know how to use it best.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I need to think about that for a little while to decide sort of what I actually think about that rate card. Look, I think it's got some advantages. I think it certainly levels the playing field from the perspective of clients in that you're not competing on price. You're competing on quality of music, quality of service. So I get that there is, from that perspective, I guess there's some advantages. And, I'm coming from a market where, very early on in my career in Australia, same way, right? The AMCOS rate card, MCPS rate card, very similar structures, different currencies, slightly different ways the licenses are structured, but similar.
Yeah.
So I think there's I think there's advantages to that, which keep little. But then again, as you've already pointed out, Simon, as soon as somebody enters the market like an Audio Network where they don't subscribe to that rate card, then all of a sudden that model is broken unless you're prepared to react. Quickly. So again, I think the MCPS has opened that up to allow there to be a certain amount of direct licensing that does take place between directly between publisher and clients. It's not necessarily via MCPS all the time, as long as there's certain parameters which are met in that regard. So I think there's yes and no. I'm not sure if I've answered that positive. I can see pluses and minuses.
Yeah. I mean, in America, it would be illegal. You can't do that. It's antitrust. So our kind of modified version of capitalism allows it. How long for, do you think? I mean, how long before we go a bit more raw in tooth and claw?
Yeah, probably not so long, I would imagine. I don't know. Yeah. But, for me, it's less about that rate card business and more about, protecting the blanket licensing for the broadcasters and being able to give the broadcasters as much as we can in the UK the rights grants that they need. And I think for me, I've always, perhaps I'm sometimes, and maybe this is what you're picking up on, Simon, perhaps sometimes I'm too optimistic,
I view
things. But I do think that there's, I've always maintained, I suppose it's coming at things maybe with some fresh eyes. When I first came over from Australia to the UK, Australia being a very, very small market, I used to hear a lot of people saying, the markets, it's become so saturated. It's so, we're up against Audio Network and there's so many things which I was told was wrong and difficult about the UK market. And I came in and looked at it, this is incredible. There's a world of opportunity. There's a lot of money on the table here. Like, this market's massive compared to the one that I've come from. And if we can go out there and get X amount of market share in these particular segments and identifying those particular targets and go after it, we're going to be successful. And that's what I directed sales teams that I've been in charge of to do. And I think we've achieved that, you know. So
John, just jumping in there on your point about protecting the blanket agreements, my question to you is, who is going to protect the blanket agreements? And the context of this is that I've been told by senior management at the BBC that they're now using up over 20 royalty-free libraries. So I don't think that includes Epidemic, well, I don't know, but it does include the bigger ones, obviously. So that is the BBC itself undermining the blanket agreements with us, the MCPS library. So I wonder who you believe is going to fight for those. Is it the PROs? Is it us? Is it the majors? Is it, you know, the ecosystem?
No, it's absolutely the PROs, and it's absolutely the, you know, PMAG committee that is, you know, are trying to advise the PROs on those negotiations.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, it's always been the challenge is giving the rights that, you know, and the difficulty is when it's a committee is that you're never going to always have the agreement of everybody in order to be able to deliver the rights that, you know, I think should be included or that I'd be prepared to include if I was in charge of this particular major company and say, yeah, from my side, we're all in, we'll give those rights in for the blanket, and some other people are going to disagree. That's where the challenge comes, you know. But I think there's there's certainly still clearly, because of what you've just said, Simon, there is clearly gaps in the rights grant in, say, the BBC blanket that needs to be addressed in order to make the MCPS controlled production music a safe, you know, I know there's a safe list option for them in terms of content that's traveling. At the same time, you know, there's also, you know, there's opportunities opening up. As I said before, you know, when the commercial publishers are taking rights out of those blankets perhaps a broadcaster has previously relied upon and don't no longer have those rights, well, that opens up opportunities for production music to fill those gaps. So it's not a perfect system, but I don't think it's completely broken either.
No, sure.
Okay, 15 years ago, I had a discussion with the CEO of Boomer Stemra, and he was talking, as a lot of CEOs of PROs do, about the collective. You know, it's great to be a part of the collective. And we had the discussion, and I said, yeah, it is, as long as the collective is making sure you're making money, that the individuals are making money. What I think that we saw back then, 15 years ago, in the Netherlands, was that the collective was making sure you didn't make money because other people were able to do the business, which you couldn't do because you were a member of the collective. And in my opinion, I see something similar happening in the UK, maybe also in other parts of the world, so that being a member of the collective gives you a disadvantage, so it's better to step out of the collective and leave. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, maybe. I think when it comes to the UK, yeah, I think, you know, obviously, if you look at something like, the blanket licenses, there's a lot of advantages in being an MCPS catalogue in terms of partaking in those blanket licenses which are put in place. You know, look at, you know, the three times weighting that production music enjoys in the UK compared to a piece of commercial music. That's significant. If you step outside of that and operate outside of that model, then, you know, you're relying purely, as Audio Network did, on performing rights. So, you know, it's a model. But, you know, you will have to be incredibly successful and I think, you know, it's probably where some of the majors previously have considered. You know, back several years ago, I know that there were majors that were looking at this sort of saying, should we step outside the MCPS? Should we change our model? Should we go directly? We'll license the broadcasters direct and we rely on the performing rights revenue. Well, you know, those majors were was almost too, they were making too much money out of those MCPS blankets to be able to give it up, you know, in order to make up the lost ground. So I think there's, once again, you know, for some people it's going to make sense if you're starting something, but, you know, for me, you know, I maintain every confidence that there's a lot of opportunity, you know, as a collective to license. As I said, it's not perfect. There's elements to it which are challenging and we need to keep discussing, talking about. But, you know, on the whole, I remain optimistic about our business.
Yeah, I'm hugely optimistic because it's music. I mean, finally, for me, it's music before it's a business. And, you know, I get up in the morning not wanting to do business but wanting to do music. I have to do business, obviously. But, John, let me ask you a question. You mentioned safe list in relation to BBC. What is the safe list?
Maybe I shouldn't have said that. Don't know, but it's a term which I've heard before. That there is a, you know, I've heard, and I may be wrong. This could be speculation. So, you know, but I've heard that there is a list that is considered safe in terms of what content is sitting on that, you know, in terms of production music libraries is listed on that safe list. Right. In terms of, it's okay, you know, using this music gives us the rights grant that we need, and whether or not, you know, there is, you know, audio networks sitting on that because, you know, they've, or the other non-MCPS catalogs are sitting on that. The goal always, you know, from a PMAG perspective was to make sure that that all MCPS controlled production music was firmly on that, you know, safe list, in inverted commas, if that exists or not. But the point is, there are people assessing it, looking at it and saying, well, what rights grant are we getting here? Like you said, so why? There's obviously a rights grant that is still where there's holes in that, those rights grants. Otherwise, they wouldn't be signing up to.
Yeah.
What would be the point of signing up to non-MCPS catalogs?
Yeah.
To be honest, and you know, if I'm 100% honest, I haven't. Yeah, I haven't been on the PMAG in recent years, so I'm not across exactly what those negotiations look like right now.
Well, John, if you could lend a hand, we're desperate to get anybody from PRS to talk to us who knows anything about anything, but they just turn us down. Same with MCPS. It seems amazing that, you know, that we've managed to talk to the head of music at Epidemic, and yet nobody from PRS is prepared to come, or MCPS. And when I asked the question at last year's AGM of PRS, my question was, what strategies has the PRS got in place to counter the disruptors like Epidemic? And the answer I got back was, it asked more questions than it answered, put it that way. And the only way I can ask those questions, there is no follow-up at the AGM, the only way I can answer those questions is on this podcast, but I can't get anybody to appear. So if you know anybody who'd be happy enough to do that, please let me know. I'm sure our listeners would be dying to hear from them. They have our life in their hands, and yet they're not prepared to publicly discuss what they're doing about the new Napster. I mean, I just find it so frustrating. I know Ferry feels the same. But Ferry's taken a different step with his company in the Holland. He's as he said, he's moving outside these organisations.
We moved outside the Stemra, which is the equivalent of the MCPS, in 2007, so that's like 15 years ago.
And you've done well with it, haven't you, Ferry? I mean, it's worked for you.
Well, I think, to be quite honest, that if we had stayed, we wouldn't have been here. Right. That sounds like a harsh remark, but I mean, it took them sometimes 6 months to send a bill to a client. So, but that's the Netherlands, and I don't want John to speak for all the performing rights organizations around the world.
So, yeah, I can't. You're probably not the right person to comment on all of those. But
but you've got experience, of course, which is very valuable. The other thing, I just want to just an idea. Do you think it should be a good idea for all the independent labels to join and make sure there's like a worldwide network and a worldwide website where they are available for all the clients around the world, to make sure they can compete with Audio Network, the majors, and Epidemic?
You mean an independent alliance?
Yeah, exactly, like a cooperative. Like that. Yeah.
Well, I think it's certainly an idea that's got legs. The problem that I think you're going to discover with something like that is that, you know, in order to create a cooperative under a new umbrella where you brought together a bunch of independents, that, yeah, potentially there's a lot of a lot of opportunity then there to sort of compete as a single cooperative and be able to compete against some of the deals or offers that majors are making to certain clients. But of course, you know, you're going to come up against issues where it's like, well, some people are going to be very happy with the kind of money that they're making in certain territories and the sub-publisher that they're with, and won't want to, it's only going to ever work if you can get a bunch of independents together, which say we're all in for every territory and we're working together. Yeah. And that's, I think that's extremely challenging to make that happen.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't think I haven't thought about it since I've left BMG.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's extremely challenging, but it's also maybe necessary.
Yeah, possibly. I think it's do you mean, Ferry, from the perspective, are you asking that question from the perspective necessary in order to compete with some of the deals that say the majors are doing with certain clients and you know, as single independents that you're unable to have a seat at that table? Is that the reason?
That's one of them. It's also
one of the reasons.
Yeah, it also has to do, of course, with the fact that if you have one platform, which, give it a name, Pandemic Music, that you can promote that one platform instead of all the platforms in all the territories. People are building platforms in every territory. They're spending a lot of money on those platforms. If you would combine that, you would be able to build a beautiful platform because every platform works worldwide.
Mm. I think one of the interesting things about Pandemic is that they've got a 1-point-something billion war chest to market their product. And, you know, that's incontrovertible. That is going to score points. If you've got that bigger a war chest, you know, even Universal is going to struggle to have that bigger war chest, I would imagine. I don't know. But certainly that it kind of makes it considerable, doesn't it? I mean, I bet you'd have liked that budget when you were there.
Absolutely. But I think it's absolutely. There's no I don't think there's any war chests in the traditional side of things that look like that at this point in time.
I mean, that's
in
amazing.
Terms of marketing budget. Really? There is an incredible amount of money that is being poured into that. So yes. Agreed.
You don't think we can't even achieve that if we put all our credit cards together? You don't think?
Well, yours fine.
maybe Ferry, what's yours look like?
Yeah, his is great.
we'll cobble something together.
We're almost at the end of the hour, but it was very interesting and a great conversation, John. Thank you very, very much for that.
You're welcome. Interesting.
What are you planning? Okay, can we make an arrangement that you come back if you started your own label, True Road Music?
Absolutely, I'd be very happy to do that, as and when or if that takes place. Once again, guys, you know, very much focused on consultancy and have a lot of conversations going on with people at the moment. But you know, if I could put a shameless plug out there too, if there's anybody listening to this that feels that they could do with a helping hand or benefit from some of the knowledge that I have. Send me
just
an email.
Give us the name of your consultancy company, John.
So True Road Music and John at trueroadmusic.tv is Brilliant. My email address. Happy to hear from anybody in terms of what's helping out there. But yeah, of course, I'd be very happy to come back if this is very much still in its infancy and me looking at this and deciding where this business goes and how I might develop it. Number of things bubbling away in the background and, still very new for me. I've never not had a job. I've always been employed since I was 18 and in this business. So, you know, leaving it, or not leaving it, but leaving the way that I'm employed, and now becoming self-employed, and looking at, you know, well, how do I carve out a different road in this, hence True Road, you know, is what I'm all about. So it's I'm still working that out, but so far so good, and once again loving all the different conversations that I'm having and connecting with a bunch of people that I haven't had the pleasure of connecting with previously, or may have, but in a different light. So it's great.
Well, it's been brilliant you talking to us, John. It's very interesting. Thanks very much.
An absolute pleasure, guys. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Thank you. Last words, famous last words from Simon.
Yeah, I just wanted to say to our listeners, Ferry, that we hope you enjoyed today's show, and we'd really appreciate if you could show your support by giving us a 5-star review on Apple or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Every review helps us to spread the word so we can help creating great shows for you in the future. Thanks in anticipation.
Okay, well, thank you very much. John, thanks again for being on Synchronized, and I hope to see you soon, parasol up or down, wherever.
Great stuff. Thank you, guys. Pleasure to be, to join you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.